Welcome back to the CritMedic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Wallenzak. I hope everyone had an opportunity to enjoy our ultrasound podcast video. Between all the different mediums we used, the episode got about 9,000 views and 100 shares or retweets. And that's not counting the shares by the folks over at EMS World. What's more important than that is that people are now talking about ultrasound, which I'm hoping leads to the adoption of this life-saving technology, because it's going to be a game-changer for us. This week, we're going to talk about what to do after ultrasound confirms that you have a tension pneumothorax. If you're in most services in the U.S., paramedics would perform a needle thoracotomy, a needle chest decompression. But studies have shown that the standard 14-gauge 4.6-centimeter catheters would reach the pleural space in only 52.7% of patients. That means that half the time, we're not even reaching the lung for decompression. What's worse than that is in a study of ATLS-trained physicians, they were able to identify the correct site for needle decompression on volunteers only 60% of the time. Our next guest thinks we can do something better than standard decompression. Clint Klepping is a flight paramedic from one of those flyover states in the Midwest. He's also heavily involved with FlightBridge and the Second Shift podcast. Clint, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners and talk about fingering?
Hi, Dominic. Thanks for having me on to the podcast. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Clint Klepping. I am a flight paramedic in Nebraska, that is in the United States, for those of you who are overseas listening. I am full-time as a flight paramedic, but I also do clinical education and training and very heavily involved in free open access medical education. And I'm pretty excited about research in the field of EMS, and I think that we can do a lot of things better than what we are currently doing them. So thanks again, Dominic, for having me on the show.
Welcome aboard, Clint. So what do you have for this week?
Basically, I just wanted to talk a little bit about finger thoracostomy. It is something that has popped up and been controversial in emergency medicine and critical care. It was talked about a lot at SMAC in Chicago in June. And really what Dr. John Hines and some of those guys have really gotten me kind of inspired to do those types of things. Cliff Reed being another one of the physicians that has inspired me to think outside that box or like there is no box. So really what I'm proposing is that we could do better with these patients who have a tension pneumothorax. You mentioned that the standard catheter is not going to reach that pleural space that we need to get into and get to the lung. And the best way to do that is to actually cut and get in there and put your finger on the lung. A lot of people say, well, you know, that's a physician only type of skill. And I do agree with what they're saying and why they're saying it. However, I don't disagree with a lot of my colleagues and friends, Michael Perlmutter being one of them. We think that we could do that for our patients and do what is right for them. And technically, the skill is really not that difficult, but it's just getting the literature and the research together to provide good evidence-based medicine to our upper management to decide to let us go ahead and do this, you know.
So what exactly is a finger thoracotomy?
A finger thoracostomy is a relatively simple procedure. It basically is the first little steps you're going to be doing to do a chest tube insertion anyway. You find that fifth rib, you go right above that fifth rib, just anterior to the mid-axillary line, and you go ahead and you cut with the scalpel right there on that fifth rib. You go over the top of that into the space. You find a good set of clamps, and you get in there and you make sure and puncture into that pleural space. Now, the big thing is to get in there and put your finger on the lung, feel the lung expand. Now, a lot of people will say, well, you know, you don't have experience at doing this type of procedure. But what's interesting is that with the right training and understanding the why behind it, we can do a lot better for these patients. I've had a lot of patients that have had tension pneumos that I could not get the standard catheter in there. And it would be beneficial to have another tool in your tool bag.
Now, do you have any data about how often this procedure is better than the standard decompression?
It's interesting that you asked that, Dominic. There are a lot of links to to different podcasts in the show notes that Scott Weingart has over at MCRIT regarding this very procedure. Now, Michael Perlmutter, I mentioned him earlier, he and I are working on doing some data collection and research on this very subject right now. So I will have that to you as soon as we can corroborate our data and figure everything out. But I can tell you that this is more often a procedure that's done by our physician counterparts, but they can definitely teach us a lot about doing this as far as nurses, flight nurses, and flight paramedics. Again, I think that it's very beneficial for us to have another tool in the tool bag whenever we're talking about these patients, because Dominic, I bet you will agree with me that our patient population is not decreasing in their size. So getting into that space in which their lung is and relieving that pressure is very, very important. And if we have to cut to get there, then so be it.
Now, what about going with just a standard chest tube if you're going to go through the effort of cutting?
So that was the other thing that a lot of folks have kind of brought up to us about, doing a finger thoracotomy in the field, or finger thoracostomy rather, in the field. And we've come up with one thing. Well, if it's a traumatic arrest, all right, most of the time, John Hines protocol dictates that we're not going to be doing external compressions. We'll do bilateral finger thoracostomies. We'll put an airway in, and we'll run fluids wide open just to – and lift the feet very, very small amount just to try to get the heart beating again regularly. That was his proposed way of dealing with those traumatic arrests. A lot of places here in the United States, it's bilateral needle decompressions, same type of procedure, but just without the thoracostomy. Now, to answer a question about the chest tube itself, it is something that a lot of services don't do in the field, and I don't blame them. There's a lot of things that can go wrong doing that in flight. A lot of people wouldn't do something like that in flight anyway, and a lot of services who fly are not going to be placing them in the facility anyway. But I get what you're saying, but the good thing about doing something like that is we can place a chest tube immediately upon arrival at the facility if we do this cut. This cut is just a good way to verify that we have lung rate expansion and things are coming out.
Now, how difficult do you think it would be for paramedics to find the proper landmarks for the cut?
I think it would be actually easier to find it on the lateral aspect than it would be to actually find the anterior space. You would be surprised, Dominic, how many people, even physicians, in certain studies have actually gotten the wrong spot when doing a trying to find the anterior space in the mid-axillary line, or rather the mid-clavicular line. So I think honestly, if you do the right education, the right training, you can teach us to find that space. We have to find it anyway, Dominic, for our alternative site for needle decompression. Although one of the latest foam casts with Lauren Westifer and Jeremy Faust, they discussed needle decompression and how the primary site should be moved to the fifth intercostal space. In the anterior axillary line, just anterior to the mid-axillary line, rather. So I think that we're already there as far as education goes. We just need to educate on the cutting part. Now, is it really that simple? No. There are a lot more complicated parts to it, medical direction being involved, the training, the education, all of that has to be brought together. But I think it's worth discussing. That's all we're doing right now is just discussing whether or not it would be efficacious to do so in the field and whether we should be allowed to do it. But I think it's worth talking about.
Now that you mentioned the primary and alternate sites, I've seen some different literature on, why one is preferred versus the other. Other than, just less adipose tissue and musculature, what reasons or what advantages does the mid-axillary site have as opposed to the mid-clavicular site?
Just what you had already mentioned about the adipose tissue and everything else. Although I will say, Dominic, in flight, a lot of times there's a lot of stuff that gets pushed up, not just adipose tissue, but, equipment, things like that. As Dr. Bill Hinckley always says, we're spending our lives in air medicine trying to combat spaghetti wires and everything else that's all up in there. And it's easier to get to that mid-axillary line and get a decompression done, whether you're no matter what aircraft you're in, almost always going to be easier to do that. Kind of like putting in a humeral head IO instead of doing one in the proximal tibia. Usually going to be easier to access when you're in the ambulance or in flight with that humeral head IO placed.
You work in a helicopter and I work in a vanbulance, so I imagine we work in relatively similar space confines.
Very, very similar. As a matter of fact, one of the first codes I ever ran was in one of those vanbulances. It's a good thing I'm short, so.
Now, when we're working at code, traumatic arrest in particular, there's usually a flurry of activity, lots of things going on, lots of procedures, lots of providers. How much additional work is it to do a finger thoracotomy as opposed to a standard needle decompression?
Well, according to Cliff Reed, not much. I asked him about it whenever I was at SMAC. I just said, hey, I got to ask you, what do you think? And he said, again, the right education and the right training has to be there in order to get this accomplished. And also evidence-based medicine. We work off of good evidence-based medicine. We don't just do something because it sounds cool or because it looks cool. He said to me that we can do it. Anybody can do it. Anybody can find those landmarks in order to do it. He says it's not difficult. Just like doing a crike isn't as difficult as a lot of people make it out to be, but you get those difficult cases where they have difficult landmarks and difficult airways, things like that. But with this, he says it's relatively simple. It's relatively easy to get into.
With needle decompression, if we encounter a hemothorax, we tend to just close the stopcock for that. What would you do differently for a hemothorax with the finger thoracotomy?
So for a hemothorax with a finger thoracotomy, we would just try to let as much of the fluid come out as that it's going to come out. We would end up covering a lot of that with some sort of occlusive dressing, not all the way occlusive. We would have a flutter valve and things like that. We wouldn't want to close it all the way because we'd want to let some of that drain out. And the other thing is to if they encounter trouble breathing, then we just let that off a little bit, let some of it drain out. Obviously, we're going to have fluids going and things of that nature. Really, what we want to get going as far as the thought process right now, Dominic, and the purpose of doing this podcast is to just talk about it. Can we and should we be doing these things? And that's what you're asking the question, and I'm trying to get out to the masses. Hey, let's talk about this.
Are there any specific contraindications for doing this procedure?
You know, obviously, you shouldn't be doing any of these procedures unless properly trained and signed off and, you know, competencies and everything else. But as far as actually doing this procedure, it seems to me, from what I've been able to find, that there's not a whole lot for contraindications, unless, of course, we can't find landmarks. That's going to be one of those things. If you have a lot of broken ribs in the area where you're going to be needing to go, that might be tough, that might be difficult, but it's going to be something that you're going to encounter. So that might be something to have to cover in training. We'll have to cover, if you have a bunch of broken ribs, your landmarks are gone, just like placing a chest tube, it's still got to be placed, right, Dominic? But we still need to have a good idea about where we're going, and that's where it gets difficult.
Now, is this something that you foresee us doing once we have additional verification of a pneumothorax?
If we get the opportunity to have ultrasound, the opportunity for ultrasound technology in the field, then we will be able to properly identify landmarks and go where we need to go. That's what I feel is going to make the difference, because I don't think that medical direction in any form or fashion is going to say, hey, yeah, it's going to be okay to let us do this in the field unless we have proper verification by ultrasound. Now, again, that puts a lot on your education and training department. But like you mentioned in your podcast on ultrasound, it would be advantageous for us to have it. There's so many different uses for it, and this is just another one of the uses for your beloved ultrasound.
So I imagine, you know, there's going to be some special equipment requirements for this procedure. It's not just going to be any scalpel willy-nilly.
You can use just about anything you can find. Obviously, it's EMS, right? We're going to do what we have to do and with what we have available. I would say a good size blade is going to be your best bet. You don't want to use a small, tiny blade for this. You definitely want to use a nice blade. And this is not a delicate procedure. As my medical director would say, that we make big boy cuts here. We're going to make a big cut in order to get in there. And we're gonna need the right equipment. The clamps are going to be important to puncture that space to get into the pleural cavity to feel our finger touch that lung. So big scalpel and a good size pair of clamps and you'll be fine just getting into that pleural space.
I don't remember who I heard talk about it. I think it might have been Weingart. But I did hear him say that sometimes just a good strong finger might be enough for the blunt dissection down to the pleural space.
Yeah, and that was also something that I was going to bring up is if you have a strong enough force behind your fingers, you can get in there pretty easily. But sometimes a set of clamps will be helpful to get through that. It just depends on the person and it depends on the situation.
Time wise, about how long does that procedure run compared to just the standard needle decompression?
If you have somebody who's trained and can really just crank it out, it would be about the same. You can take a little bit longer doing this procedure, but it's all about being able to verify. So many times we think we're in the right spot with those needles and we just don't get to where we need to get to, and that's what makes the problem, and that's where we find further problems, because we're mechanically ventilating these patients, we're making things worse, we're increasing that intrathoracic pressure, and it's just things are going downhill and we have no real verification. Now, if we put our finger on the lung, that's pretty decent verification in my opinion.
Do you think most providers will be able to feel the lung with this procedure?
I think so. It just depends on, you know, how much did the lung actually collapse at that point? And how much expansion did you have when you actually got through the pleural space? I think it depends on that. A lot of people joke because I have small hands, and so they joke that I couldn't get my finger in there and it's not long enough to feel the lung. But when you get expansion, it's going to get in there and it's going to actually expand enough for you to feel that lung. So I think it's just different for each case. It's a case by case basis. But when you get blood come out and if you hear anything, that's a plus. Obviously, if you hear a hiss, that's a plus, but you may not always hear that. So feeling the lung expand is going to be a good indication, but you bring up a good point. Can you always feel it? If it does what it's supposed to do, you will feel it.
Well, I'm glad to have to say it's definitely an interesting concept. I don't think it's something that most providers think of every day or have necessarily on their radar. But any final closing thoughts you have on the finger thoracostomy?
Just that I think that we have to continue looking forward. In order for us to move forward as a profession and in order for flight medicine to take off in the United States and become what it really could be, we have to continue to look at those procedures that other people are doing and other countries are doing and continue to just make ourselves better. And thanks for having me on the show, Dominic. It's a pleasure to talk to you about things that we're not talking about daily. So thanks a lot for everything, and I appreciate you taking the time.
So there you have it, Crit Medic listeners. I'm sure many of you haven't heard of a finger thoracostomy before. I know I've only vaguely heard of it, but it seems to be an interesting concept. It's probably not something that will replace needle decompression tomorrow, but it's worthwhile discussing because it may be something that becomes popular further down the line, and we need to be prepared for it if that time does come. I'm sure Clint will cover it again on the Second Shift podcast once he completes his review of the relevant literature, and you bet we'll share that once he does. That's all for this week. As always, Crit Medic listeners, keep thinking differently.